Off the Ball on News Talk 106 to 108.
And we shall wonder if one day our game is played on the other planets. We will have interplanetary competitions.
Your job now is to stand by our new manager.
I always said if I was Aladicio, they'd probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
If my granny had bought, she'd be my granddad.
Big Sam Aladicio, that's right.
So still 1-1 at the Emirates, 72 minutes gone. This game is lively.
That's a brilliant game. We said earlier that the games recently involving Arsenal and the other top sides have been really good to watch. And this has been as good as the United-Arsenal game, as the Liverpool-Arsenal game. Plenty of chances. Both goalkeepers have been forced to bring out some really good saves. Cesc Fabregas has just been replaced by Danny Drinkwater, and he has had his entire array of passing on display tonight, Fabregas. Yeah. He's just put in this gorgeous ball where he just stroked it with the outside of his right foot in behind the defender and Morata, knowing Morata knew where it was going to go, and Morata just should have scored. He tried to clip it over the onrushing Petr Cech, but he put it high and wide, and Chelsea's response to going behind to that Wiltshire goal has been absolutely first class, and they're very lucky, Arsenal, that they haven't gone behind. On the penalty, soft, like there was very little contact, but I think it would have been a free kick anywhere else on the pitch. Yeah. Bellerin probably didn't need to tackle Eden Hazard because he was trying to move the ball away from goal. He just needed to shepherd him. But yeah, he put in the tackle and he kind of kicked him on the underside of his right foot.
Yeah.
And Hazard obviously crumpled to the ground, referee pointed the spot. Probably a penalty, but very soft.
Wiltshire's goal was good, as you said. That is Wiltshire's first goal in the league in a long time.
Since May 2015. He's got one goal this season in the Europa League, but he hasn't scored in the Premier League for 3.5 years.
Yeah.
And he looks like he's back to his best tonight. The goal was really well taken. His passing has been very good tonight as well. He's snapped into a couple of tackles as well. He is fond of a tackle despite all the injury issues he's had over the years. And already, you know that English journalists are going to put him up there on a pedestal to shoot him down by the time they get to the midway through the group stages of the World Cup in Russia.
We will talk to Keith Andrews at full time, who's watching that game, and we'll talk to Graeme Hunter in just a second as the La Liga season gets ready to resume at the weekend. But we didn't mention Mark Hughes last night, and we felt we had intended to, but we just went a bit overboard with Man United talk. So the board of directors at Stoke have not met formally to discuss Hughes's position, but they are weighing up the options. Hughes and Stoke are two places above the relegation zone. They've lost 7 of their last 10. They've taken 20 points from their opening 22 games. They've let in 47 goals, which is the most in the division, the most in the top 5 European leagues. And 47 goals is more than Tony Pulis let in the entire 2012-13 season, after which he was sacked, to give you a measure of what they've got here. So the Hughes press conference after the Newcastle defeat ended with Mark Hughes leaving.
What would you have done? You would have played two strong teams?
No, I would have. What I'm saying is you've saved it for this game, by the look of it. That's what people will think. You've saved the...
I've just said, yeah, 40.
And then you...
I've made the decision in the second half at Chelsea to say, right, OK, we can't win this game. I will pick these players and look after them, and with the view that we'll be stronger and... I'm better equipped to play a second game in 48 hours. That's what I've done. And I'm going to get criticised for that. I think it's unfair if I do.
Any more questions about today?
No? Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Mark. Sorry, boss.
There are no more questions about tonight.
No. Manager's entitled to rest players against Chelsea if he's a thin enough squad and it's a vital game 2 days later, I think.
And not even necessarily resting them, just taking off some key men when the game is clearly gone. But he is under huge pressure. He has been in that situation for weeks now. And the problem for him is that the situation doesn't look like it's going to improve. And now it's all happening with the opening of the January transfer window. So if you're going to make a change, you need to make it now, yesterday, tomorrow, because you want to give a new manager at least a couple of weeks to bring in a couple of players of their own. Otherwise, you've got the same squad between now and the end of the season, and they're sinking like a stone at the moment.
Well, the BBC are reporting that he will take charge of the FA Cup game against Coventry on Saturday. So that's the latest on Mark Hughes. What is the latest on Graeme Hunter is the more pertinent question.
I love being pertinent. Phillies annual, as we would say over here. I know it's belated news, but happy new year to all of you that listen to the show. I'm glad to be back. It's brilliant that the football's back. I missed, I've been listening to the debate, and I know that today's game maybe doesn't represent that, but this debate sparked by Pep Guardiola about what do you expect from the footballers when, you know, you beat the hell out of them with a game every 25 seconds over the festive period. And I think he makes a decent point. And, you know, having seen some of the sterile English and Scottish games. I attended one over the festive period. I'm so glad that Spanish is back, and the Cup's started already, as you probably know.
Yeah.
And the Beast is back. Diego Costa's back.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was on your agenda to ask me about tonight, but I've been watching him come on, make his second debut for Atleti, win in a 4-0 victory up in Catalonia and Lleida.
Is he injured, Graham? Did he pick up a knee injury?
He took a kick. What happened was he got a goal. Really lovely finishing. Typical of him. Took a kick. Looked like he might come off. Looked like it was. It might be muscular, but it has been a kick. Now how they treat it, particularly when a guy's been inactive for so long. I mean, we talked on the show a few weeks ago about how the physical regime under the Professor Ortega, which is infamous and which has been brutal for him, has seen him lose at least 6 or 7 kilos. So he looks a different beast altogether. But when you've been out that long, you're always going to be prone to the body saying, well, what is this match tempo you're asking me to get at? And even though he's a hell of a physical specimen at the moment, they're going to have to be careful. But it looked more like an impact injury. Looked like he was going to have to stop. His goal is good. He got in a row again. Basically, Diego is back.
In every way. So
all the things that make him famous, Joe, yeah.
Yeah. So, and do you share? I mean, I would tend to share Pep's point. Like, there is just too much football. And, like, tonight has been non-sterile and really, really good. It's been wild, if anything. It's been great fun to watch. But, I mean, there is just too much football on the television. We don't even need this much football as viewers.
No, listen, I certainly don't need the kind of football I've been glimpsing at, where it's clear that you're looking at players whose spark has gone. Yeah. Now, that's not... Pep's point, I don't think, has been about what value entertainment are we giving. The point that both he and Wenger and Mourinho, in increasingly stentorian voices... It's funny how the tide of debate and tide of opinion changes, irrespective of whether we like to call ourselves, you know, opinion makers in our comments. It's vital that the game speaks. And for a handful of years here in Spain, looking back at Britain, I've watched players and fans and the media fall in love with the particularly Boxing Day crowds, but festive football in England. Although the footballers who've been in Spain and then lose their short break. I mean, the last game was played here, whatever, on the afternoon, evening of the 23rd.
Yeah.
And then we're playing again tonight, and most teams were back in pre-season training. Pre-season training. Their build-up again started 30th, 31st of December. So it's a mini-break compared to when I first moved here 15 years ago. Mm. But the players still talk fondly about the ability to have a short break. Mm. And now that it's not 2 weeks as it once was here, it's effectively them saying, we like to switch off. Even just clearing up an niggling injury, disconnecting a little bit. Now, I think that fits in tune with what the central thing Guardiola was saying. One, it's beneficial that footballers can just press the reset button, even if it's for 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 days. But secondly, when you push them as much as is happening right now in the Premier League, you will get burnout, you'll get a lack of creativity, you'll get stress injuries, and you'll get a lack of performance in March, April, when, you know, in the first half of the season, we would all say this very much looks like a totally English-dominated Champions League latter stage is coming. That may well still be the case, but this period now will be forgotten about, won't be talked about, won't be analysed as well when it comes to March, April, when the Champions League is being sorted out properly, and when the World Cup comes in Russia, people won't be talking about this impact, except for maybe the players and the coaches. Fans and analysts probably won't be, and this is definitely where we burn them right down to the bare bones, and if we don't see it now, we do see it later in the season.
Yeah, so a few bits and pieces from over the last couple of weeks in Spain. Sevilla obviously sacked Eduardo Brizzo. That was on the 22nd, I think. They went 4 games without a win. And then Diego Costa's back. I suppose from a Zinedine Zidane point of view. Like, I cleared my schedule on the 23rd. I had all my shopping done. I was, you know, like, this is taking
we're
priority.
We're always glad to help with your schedule. Yeah. You got your shopping done early. The class school earned its weight.
It was the earliest I had done, actually, and it was made it stress-free. But so I cleared the decks for this game and was massively disappointed with Real Madrid, mainly the Real Madrid approach.
Yeah.
And very un-Zidane-like, actually. And so,
couldn't agree more, Joe, yeah.
So you know, I was kind of watching and they're at the Bernabeu and, like, this is really, you know, a draw is not much good to them, and Isco and Bale are on the bench, and I think it was Kovacic he went with?
Yeah, correct. Mark, to try and close a double pivot, because Rakitic and Busquets played together in the middle of the field, and he didn't want to give them space.
Yeah.
And also he wanted to have Kovacic, not limpet like Catenaccio-style man-marking, but still spending spells man-marking Messi, depending on where the ball was in the pitch.
And it backfired quite spectacularly when he ran to go with Messi instead of stopping a player in possession run right through the heart of their...
Rakitic, running forward. You're right.
Okay, so everybody's up to speed on that. So what have the last 2 weeks been like with Zidane having to stew on that decision, which backfires?
They haven't. It's a continuation of what we've been talking about before, because effectively everybody just zipped off. There's been very little ability to get to the main protagonist. The only way in which this has developed a little bit is that, you know, Benzema had another poor game, despite hitting the post. Whether that does or doesn't represent Real Madrid's best chance during the Clásico, he had another game where, as live as he looks, as match fit as he appears to be, the decisions are all going against him. His own decisions are turning out wrong. He looks a beat off the game in that way that when a creative player loses confidence. And now what's happened is he left the game for tactical reasons. He was followed, as all the players were followed, to the airport to try and get extra quotes that night of the 23rd. They all took their private jets away to left, right and centre around the globe. And he wasn't limping. He's now injured. The club are saying that he injured himself in the Champions League. There was footage of him in private social media having a little boogie on Hogmanay, seeming to be fine. Nice. But now he's injured. It looks like he'll be out for 2-3 weeks. And the patience with Benzema has dropped right out the bottom of everybody, in terms of almost everybody except for perhaps Zidane, whose faith in him remains very high indeed. I don't know what your feelings are about the drama in North London at the moment, but
we should mention it. Chelsea have just gone 2-1 up away to Arsenal, 84 minutes in the clock. Dave, I didn't see it. It was Alonso.
Marcus Alonso, who has been getting forward real regularity in this game. There was a ball played back towards the halfway line by Chelsea and then just whipped from left to right. Lovely diagonal ball down that right hand side. I think it's Zappacosta who's come on, who just managed to turn, I think it's Maitland-Niles, and he's got the ball across
finish.
And in the centre forwards position, Marcus Alonso has come steaming into the right corner of the 6-yard box and just hit it first time into the corner. It was a Morata type finish, and Chelsea have turned this around. There's 6 minutes left, they're leading 2-1, and it looks like it's going to be one win in 13 Premier League games against Chelsea for Arsene Wenger.
It's such a good finish with his right foot. So 2-1, 7 minutes to go. So Zidane is still okay with Benzema, Graham?
Yeah, he's backing him, and he's sticking to the idea that this was a match injury rather than something Benzema has done personally over the holiday period. That really has caused a furore here amongst supporters, Madrid-based commentators. And Zidane has been pinpointed it for all the things that you argued tactically. One, what was the idea in the game? And it was so anti-Real Madrid at home. It was so anti the way they played the last two Clásicos when they thrashed Barca 5-1. And it also didn't work as two separate concepts. And therefore, there will be a critical scrutiny on Zidane, but at the moment, you can hear the battening down of the hatches for them to say, well, albeit that there's a Valencia game coming towards the end of the month at the Mestalla, Barca have played the majority of their really big testing games away, at Atleti, at Real Madrid, at the Mestalla, and Madrid largely still have those away tests to come. The battening down of the hatches is all about, can Zidane get the tempo right again, the confidence right again? Can he get the key players performing again? Bale will play. in the cup away at Numancia. It's this tiny little town, if you remember, where Pep Guardiola's first competitive bus on a game ended in defeat. And Numancia have drawn River in the cup, and that's tomorrow night at the same time as Barca are playing up in Galicia away to Celta Vigo. So two completely different ties, and it shouldn't really be a threat for Real Madrid. But Bale will be playing up front in place of Benzema, and it's time now that Bale backs those of us, myself included, who've been defensive of the way in which people have underestimated his contribution this season, because pound for pound, and he very nearly turned the Clásico twice, pound for pound, I think, although he hasn't played much football this season, he's played his best Real Madrid football this season. The weight is now on him to put things right up front, to create for Cristiano, to score, to impose himself, and clearly everybody's screaming at the radio, stay fit for a couple of weeks at a time. But the spotlight moves from Zidane through Benzema now on to Bale.
What if we move the spotlight to Barcelona, Graham, and this mysterious thigh injury that has somehow re-emerged for Philippe Coutinho?
It's funny, we used to say that, you know, a player is famous when you only have to use his first name. But when you only have to use the injury, you never have to say Coutinho, that's real fame, no?
Well, it's definitely ruled him out of the cup tie at Everton in the third round of the FA Cup. I took it personally that the signing of Van Dijk for 75 million was the guarantee for me that he was going, that they didn't have that money available to sign a player for that amount of money unless they were already spending the Coutinho money. I mean, how likely is it that this is finally going to get done before the closing of the transfer window?
Yeah, well, I have to admit that I thought it was a difficult one for them to do this window. It's clear for anybody who hasn't followed it closely, he can't play in the Champions League. Yeah. Barcelona shouldn't need a player of Coutinho's quality to see them home in La Liga. The concept of him playing at Football Club Barcelona is now established, that with the Nike gaffe of them saying, you know, he's ready to shine and produces, this is where the magic happens, and Coutinho's ready to shine. When Nike are doing that, although it's an extraordinary, a terrible gaffe, it's clear they want a brand name player, Nike, playing for the number one brand name club, Barcelona, instead of playing in New Balance. It's clear they're behind the move, that they will help Barcelona with it. It's clear that the price is something that, if Barcelona are willing to abandon lots of other things, David, and I think that's what you're hinting at. For example, just before the Clásico, Atletico Madrid said, they did actually report Barca to FIFA for tapping up Griezmann. One of the Barca executives, Guillermo Amor, you remember him as a player, spoke out and spoke clumsily and pretty much admitted that they had contacted Griezmann's family and representatives and that they were working through the how-to with Griezmann. Atleti have said, we went to his people, we spoke to them, we now are absolutely clear. We don't want to sue them, we don't want to cause them a row with FIFA, we're asking them to back off and show some respect. So what's established now is that Griezmann, who's priced 100 million euros, is somebody that they want in the summer and think that they'll get.
Nice.
They've just brought Dembele back into the squad for Celta Vigo. This kid, who's got so much to grow and so much to learn, cost over 100 million euros. Now, Coutinho, if Liverpool do sell, which is quite clear they're going to, whether it's now or summer, and there's a lot of debate to happen to answer your question about whether it's in January, that means that Barcelona will have ended up spending, if they sign all three players, 340 million euros on three footballers at a time when they can't afford to commence the stadium remodeling, which is going to cost them 500 million euros, which has been budgeted, which has been planned, which is supposed to start not in summer 2017, but summer 2016. It's now wildly behind schedule. They can't afford all three players. They have to clear footballers out. They will need to sell and sell really, really well. So the conditions, to answer your question properly and say, does Coutinho happen in January? They aren't clear yet. It's clear that Coutinho wants, in my view, from what we've been told here and his actions there, it's clear that Coutinho thinks he's done his job by seeing Liverpool through to the Porto.
He's been
game.
Playing like a player that was told, just give us 4 months, we'll let
give
you leave in January.
And then we'll play ball with
because
you.
Because Alexis Sanchez, for the most part, has been playing in a very opposite fashion. He has been playing like a player that's been told, well, look, we're definitely not letting you go in January, and we're going to keep rabbiting on at you about a new contract between now and then. It just looks like there was some kind of a behind-the-scenes deal done between Jurgen Klopp and Philippe Coutinho.
Mm. Well, you're talking about the mechanisms, which I think is what we're supposed to report on, and I agree with all of that. But I think that because all of us, all three of us, spend enough time meeting these players, meeting their representatives, meeting managers and talking to them, there is in my mind a little bit of confusion about what motivates Coutinho. He clearly, in his mind, wants to be at Barcelona as quickly as possible. Maybe he thinks that for the World Cup to go well, he needs to spend the next few months bedded in and by the summertime be clear about his blah, blah, blah. Yeah. But he's not gonna play in the Champions League. He's not going to win the Champions League. Maybe he doesn't win the Champions League with Liverpool, but I think they go through against Porto. And by the last 16, you're there, you're involved. There is something interesting happening at Anfield. They're playing a different brand of football. And with Van Dijk, you just, I suppose, never know. Stranger things have happened. I would only argue that if it were me, and this were my choice, I'd be saying to Liverpool, you've got me until May. I want the deal to be concluded. No mucking about before Russia. I want it to happen instantly, the season's finished, but I'll see out the season with you. It doesn't look like that's what Coutinho feels, but as we analyse these multimillionaire players and their decisions, that's what confuses me a little bit.
Yeah. It's a fair point. By the way, you mentioned Dembele coming back there. Like, his fee could rise to 135 million sterling.
Yeah, sterling, that's right.
Which is kind of a scary thing for a 20-year-old.
They overpaid.
Yeah, what are the expectations around Camp Nou for him?
I think that they've been tempered. I think that when he arrived, the expectations were, please God, give us somebody who can play like Neymar.
Yeah.
It was absolutely evident based on, if you watched him at Rennes, if you watched him, well,
oh my God!
I think this is a very Spanish night in North London.
It really is. We've seen Marcus Alonso
put
Chelsea in front, and Hector Bellerin. You're referring to the penalty, aren't you? We'll talk about that in a sec. Hector Bellerin has just sent in a wonderfully executed volley. I think it just fell to him on the rise. Arsenal have just been pumping balls into the Chelsea penalty area. They've dealt with most of them. Marcus Alonso heads a ball out towards the edge of the 18-yard box, and Bellerin catches it so sweetly on the half volley, on the instep as well. Oh, it's a gorgeous finish. Technically as difficult as a volley can be, and it's bending away from Thibaut Courtois, who can't get near despite going full stretch into the far corner. 2-2, a 92 and a half minutes played. Oh, Chelsea have a chance to go in front, and Jack has just beaten it away, and it's just blazed off the bar. Oh, what a culmination to what's been an absolutely brilliant game. I wasn't sure who it was following up. It might have been Zappacosta. Hit a volley, rattles off the middle of the crossbar on the rebound of the shot that had just been saved and parried away by Petr Cech. Neither of these sides are willing to settle for a point at the moment, and now Arsenal are on the counter-attack. This is thrilling stuff.
Yeah,
lads, do we need to phone Pep Guardiola and just tell him that we take all our words back, all our analysis, and we don't believe anything about the too much football leaves footballers sterile?
That's fair enough.
I don't change my analysis of what he was saying or my backing for his idea one little bit, but boy, this is top class entertainment. And with the cup coming up over tonight and tomorrow night, and then La Liga starting at the weekend, I hope the Spanish players can be as entertaining in La Liga and La Copa as they have been at the Emirates tonight. This has been sensational.
Yeah. He's not Neymar Mark II.
You were finishing the year. Dembele, at that stage, it felt to the Barcelona fans and commentators like, please give us somebody that we can pin our hopes on. They've found that is now the team. That although I still have my doubts about them being elite and still have my doubts about them being Champions League contenders, the unity, the hard work, the solutions that Valverde has found, the ability to leave this kind of gap between them and Real Madrid has changed the mood, and therefore Dembele, to his great good fortune, will have a little bit of time to grow because what we saw before his injury was, although he has tremendous pace, tremendous dribbling skills, and that's full time between Arsenal and Chelsea, David, at 2-2, but I'll finish and leave that analysis to you by saying that what we saw is that he's got one hell of a lot to earn. He doesn't work, he doesn't chase, he doesn't press the way in which this team has made their trademark. And therefore, at his age, why wouldn't it? This is going to be somebody who's got a lot of learning to do, and I think that's motivating the Coutinho idea, that if Barca take him in now, they can rotate between the two of them, the pressure goes off Dembele, and he's allowed to grow organically, to learn and to get maturity and to test out this muscle injury, which was so devastating.
Okay, excellent stuff. Good to talk to you again. Thanks, Graham.
Super fellas, glad to be back. Cheers for now.
Graham Hunter there with, covering it all, really. La Liga gets back back underway at the weekend. As Graham said, full time at the Emirates, an amazing 2-2 draw. Keith Andrews has been at home with his feet up watching, and he'll talk to us next.
Off the ball
on News Talk,
in association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.
You're welcome, Max. So, thrilling finish and thrilling last half hour, really, at the Emirates. It's finished 2-2 between Arsenal and Chelsea. What it means for the league table is that Manchester United stay in second place. They're a point ahead of Chelsea, and Arsenal stay in sixth. They're 5 points off fourth spot. So, an amazing 2-2 draw between Arsenal and Chelsea at the Emirates. Jack Wilshere opened the scoring for Arsenal on 63 minutes to go 1-0 up, and then it was 4 minutes later. They could only hang on to the lead for 3-4 minutes. There was a penalty, soft enough penalty, Eden Hazard with the equaliser for Arsenal. And then in the 84th minute, Marcus Alonso with just a really brilliant, tidy finish from across low, and he took it really well on his right foot, finished it like a striker, as Dave said. And then drama in the 90th minute, Hector Bellerin with an absolutely brilliant volley. We'll get the thoughts of Keith Andrews in just a second. Nigel Bidmead was at the Emirates.
Arsenal 2, Chelsea 2. This was a classic London derby with a bit of everything, including a stoppage time equaliser. Arsenal took the lead through Jack Wilshere on 63, his first Arsenal goal for 2.5 years. Chelsea equalised from the penalty spot after Hector Bellerin brought down Eden Hazard, the Belgian scoring from the spot. Chelsea thought they'd won it with a late goal from Marcus Alonso to make it 2-1, a first time close range finish. But Bellerin, with a half volley in the second minute of injury time, salvaged the point for the Gunners. Arsenal 2, Chelsea 2.
And Keith Andrews was watching from the comfort of a couch somewhere. Evening, Keith.
Hey, Joe, how are you?
Very good. You got your evening's entertainment worth.
Oh, what a game. Yeah, very, very entertaining. I was getting ready to kind of do me 2-1 speech for Chelsea, and I was getting ready to say it would have been very, very harsh on Arsenal because they deserved something from the game. I thought they were outstanding, certainly going forward. I thought attacking-wise, both teams magnificent. Goalkeeper-wise, good. And defensively, which is unusual for Chelsea, very, very average on both sides.
Yeah, I mean, Dave and I are watching here in studio whilst also doing the show, but every time I glanced up, there was a certain wildness to the game, like the pace of it was up, and then both sets of back fours, or in Chelsea's case, back three, I suppose, but there was a big old distance between the two of them for a lot of the game. There was a lot of space in that midfield area for a lot of very good technical players.
Yeah, you don't really expect that from Chelsea, do you? For Arsenal, you kind of become accustomed to it. Wilshere's been a little bit more responsible since he's come back into the team in recent weeks. Jack, it's not in his DNA to be kind of defensive orientated. He's more on the ball and kind of dictating proceedings. But I thought the big letdown for Chelsea tonight was Bakayoko on the heart of midfield. He left Kante so exposed on his own, and Mesut Ozil in the first half in particular was picking up lots of little pockets that were really hurting that Chelsea backline. They just couldn't really capitalise on it. And then in the second half, it was literally just end-to-end stuff. It was riveting to watch.
Bakayoko's a strange player. Like, physically, absolutely brilliant. But you wouldn't say technically he's overly sharp on the ball. And then if you're saying defensively he left Kante to dry, you boil all that together and you would say there's a lot of work there.
Yeah, well, I seen him live for the second time on Saturday. I was at the game against Stoke on Saturday. And he came on, and Stoke were basically defending with 10 men behind the ball. And he didn't show anything in possession. He didn't show any type of guile, any type of quality in possession with the ability to unlock a door and show a little bit of creativity. When there's space for him to run into and show that physicality that he has, he can cover the ground so easily. When in the first half, at times gone forward, he looked very, very impressive. Right. But as soon as Arsenal got into their stroll and it was their turn to have a little dabble, he was very, very much found out.
Keith, why did Kante not change that? Because Kante was as exposed in the second half as he was the first. And it's as ineffective, I think, as I've seen N'Golo Kante in a Premier League game for quite some time. When he has Danny Drinkwater, a player who we know has been so effective in alongside Kante for Leicester in that midfield, and he didn't come on for the last few minutes. I just wonder why he didn't recognise, as you've been talking about at half-time, that they were just being played through centrally and Kante was having no effect on the game.
Yeah, I totally agree. And he played, I know it was against Stoke, which I've already said on Saturday, but he played with Drinkwater on Saturday. It just looked a lot more settled. And tonight was probably the first time I've ever seen Kante looking frustrated, because he's the nicest man on the planet. But looks at it, he very lets his kind of emotions get the better of him. He looked frustrated tonight.
Like, he's normally drawn to the ball, or the ball's normally drawn to him, but he couldn't get near it tonight.
He bypassed. Yeah, right, David. The game bypassed him in a lot of cases, because we always speak about him, and certainly in the previous 2 years, about he does two men jobs. Tonight he was having to do that. We know what Fabregas is like out of possession. He was also in there. Bakayoko, his awareness of in particular Mesut Ozil, who, by the way, is clearly aware that the January sales are open and keen on a move, and I would throw Sanchez into that equation as well. Them two are outstanding tonight, where they've been missing, certainly the early part of the season. But yeah, Bakayoko would be a worry for me, and if it was up to me, I would put Drinkwater in alongside Kante.
Jack Wilshere turned 26 years old on New Year's Day. Today was his sixth consecutive league appearance for Arsenal. So it's the first time since 2013 he's played six league games in a row for Arsenal. It's also about the first time he's scored in the league in about 2.5 years. So you think of the Wilshere who popped up for Bolton, and Paul Scholes was saying he was the best 18, 19-year-old he'd played against in some time. And here we are 7, 8 years later. I mean, if he can stay fit is one. But then two, like, how did Wilshere look to you out there? I mean, does he look like a guy who's ready to kick on finally at this stage in his career?
I must confess, Joe, I'm not as big a fan as a lot of other people seem to be about Jack Wilshere. And I sincerely hope he stays fit and keeps in the team, because I do think he's a very good player, but not to the level where I hear a lot of other people, ex-players, etc., go on about him. I think he's too loose in possession. I'm not sure what his best position is, in terms of he's not reliable enough to play in a two in there, where we're speaking about Bakayoko's defensive qualities. I would throw Jack Wilshere into that. But having said that, he's playing for a manager who is not particularly interested in playing the game without the ball. Mm. So how much you can judge him on that, I'm not too sure. I've seen quite a bit of Matt Bournemouth last year playing as a number 10 in an average side, and he looked like an average player. So, look, I'm delighted he's back playing and fit and getting regular game time, and he looked decent. But, you know, there's a big talk about, you know, Gay crashing the World Cup squad for England. I think that's mainly down to the fact that England's midfield certainly isn't as good as it was in years gone by.
Well, on tonight's Evans, he's the best they have, isn't he?
England.
Yeah. Like, if you think of that, I don't know, do you play a Dele Alli and a Jack Wilshere in the same 11, for example? But they don't really have anyone else like him. And I think he's shown a lot of character. The loan move at Bournemouth ended prematurely because he picked up an injury. He wasn't getting a look into the Premier League this season. He was only been thrown into weakened sides when they're playing in the Europa League. And here he is, having kept the likes of Coquelin and Elneny, who are both obviously more defensive players, out of the team. Fair enough, if Ramsey Cazorla were fit, maybe he wouldn't be in the team. But do you not think he's shown guts to get back to a place where he's actually maybe in a position of power when it comes to bargaining a new contract, where 2 months ago it looked like he'd no chance of staying at the club?
Very much so, and it comes down to the fitness, but also the character. I admire him for the character. I just don't put him on that pedestal that a lot of other people seem to. I think he's too risky in possession. I think he gives the ball away too often in a team that in normal terms you dominate majority of possession in games. I think he's loose. I think he's very, very loose. And
has he always been loose? Has he always been loose, Keith?
I think in his first couple of years, he was an outstanding game. I remember that game against Barcelona when he literally drove the game forward for Arsenal. But we're probably talking 4 or 5 years ago now, Joe, at this stage. And like I said, I'm not having a go at Jack Wilshere. I think he's a very good player, but I just don't see him as, you know, borderline world class, which a lot of people seem to harp on about. I just don't see it.
Yeah, no, because I do distinctly remember Scholes making that point about Wilshere at 19 and thinking this guy actually could be world class.
And maybe he would have been had he not had such a difficult time with injury.
Injuries,
Keith, you say you're not having a go at Wilshere. We've all had a go at Arsenal many, many times over the last few years.
I can't think of a man who hates Arsenal more than Keith Andrews.
But the word character isn't something we would have used in regard to Arsenal for quite some time. But they're 2-0 down against Liverpool. They turn it around and could have won the game. 2-1 down tonight against Chelsea, and they've managed to battle away and get themselves a point. They've gone to Burnley and won recently. I just wonder, while still conceding a pile of goals, that maybe is more of a structural issue than a mental or a characteristic, are they showing a bit more steel and guts than they have in the past when they've just imploded when things have gone against them?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And you're right, Joe. I'm quick to criticise Arsenal because I just think it's...
They represent everything in the game of football that you dislike, I think.
Yeah, well, I just think you have to pay your opponents the respect they deserve, some more than others, obviously.
By actually analysing them.
Yeah, and you know, maybe touching on their strengths and weaknesses, etc., and not just worrying about your own starting 11. And I think in years gone by, he would have got away with that with his better Arsenal times teams, whereas in the last few years, he hasn't been able to do that. But yeah, you're right. In terms of them, they've only lost to Man United and Man City in the Premier League since mid-October. So they are on a very good run. I'll go back to Mesut Ozil and Alexis Sanchez. They were the catalyst tonight for me in terms of their attitude and their hunger and their desire to make things happen and to drive the team forward. Now, that hasn't happened, as we all know, for obvious reasons. Mesut Ozil frustrates the life out of me. But tonight, if he plays like that, he could walk into practically any team in the world because he was outstanding. And it comes from his desire to basically run around.
He's done it a few times lately. Again, I mean, the transfer window has been looming, so it's hard to know what his motives are, but he has done it a few times of late. You were at St. Mary's last night, Keith, were you?
I was, yeah. First half at Crystal Palace, they'd obviously gone through that game on Sunday against Man City, could have won it, got a very good draw, lost the missed a penalty in the last couple of minutes, and they looked like they'd played the day before, never mind 2 days before. They looked so lethargic. They were lucky to be still in the game. Shane Long obviously got the goal. He could have scored within 15 seconds, actually. He had a very, very good chance. He got a little bit of contact by Tompkins, possibly put him off. But I'm sure the whole country was just delighted to see him kind of get that goal. And Southampton were outstanding in the first half. As bad as Crystal Palace were, outstanding. But in the second half, it turned on its head. Roy Hodgson, to be fair to him, made a couple of decisions tactically, went 4-4-2, put Zaha up front, and he was a man possessed in the second half. He really was. And Southampton really got on the back foot. As soon as they equalised Crystal Palace, there was only going to be one winner, unfortunately. And they're in a really, really delicate position now, which, to be fair, the majority of teams in that bottom half of the division, I think it's a fascinating half of the table. I really do. And I wouldn't be betting on who's going to go down.
We didn't really talk about Chelsea. At this point, would you fancy Manchester United or Chelsea to finish second? Because that's how that's what we've been reduced to now with Man City's dominance. Who's going to finish second?
I think it's harsh leaving Liverpool out of that discussion as well, given how they're playing.
I think there's some good teams. You know, Spurs are coming into the form. They've got a bit of chasing to do in terms of where they are in the league. But, you know, United have slipped up in recent weeks. Only a point in, obviously. I'm not sure. I think it'll go all the way. I really do. But I think, yeah, you're right, Dave. I think Liverpool could get in that equation. You would imagine Coutinho's going to leave in January. The top four race, look, the Man City are going to be champions. I think everyone's kind of given up on that in the last few weeks. But the top four race, I think, is going to be very, very interesting. And then the relegation battle is going to be between 10 teams. In the next few weeks, you would imagine some will pull away. And I would throw Crystal Palace into that equation because he's done a magnificent job there, Roy Hodgson. But if you ask me now, I still think United might do it.
Liverpool play City at home on January 14th. And that will tell us an awful lot about where Liverpool are.
Right.
Yeah, big time. And look, they need to get Van Dijk up to speed, but I don't think he's going to be the, you know, he's not going to be the golden ticket. There's fundamental problems.
The defensive silver bullet.
You know, he's the goalkeeping situation, who plays alongside him, how vulnerable is he. What he has done in the last couple of months, I would say, is he's played Gomez more often than not right back, and he's not as adventurous. He's told him to basically stay. So if you look at their side at times when they're attacking, at times it looks like a back three, because Gomez half stays to be wary of the counter-attack from the opposition, whereas before, the two centre-halves were so vulnerable, they really were.
Mark Lawrenson was on last night and he said Gomez is going to be the ultimate partner for Van Dijk.
Yeah, I really like him.
Yeah.
I think he's got a really good temperament. His awareness, his positioning is very good. In possession, not a problem at all, very, very good, but it's not his biggest strength. His biggest strengths are defending, which is actually refreshing to hear from a player that actually plays in the back four. So yeah, I'm a big fan of his as well. I'd very much go along with that.
Okay, well, we're out of time, so in short, 2-2 draw, fair enough result tonight.
Yeah, very much so. And I don't often say that, but I'm glad for Arsenal they deserve it tonight.
You won't be when you see their selfies from after the game in the dressing
don't
room.
Don't tell me that.
Thanks a million.
See you, lads. Take care.
Off the ball on News Talk.
In association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.
That's bullshit, said Dave McIntyre during the ad break. As we watched Jamie Carragher say that man for man, Arsenal's front three is better than Man City's front three.
He said that Ozil, Sanchez and Lacazette are a better trio than Sterling, Aguero and Sané. On the basis of this season, that's absolute horse manure.
He did qualify by saying, some people might disagree with me.
Yeah, me.
I think everyone watching.
Clearly, Jamie, you know an awful lot more about the game than I do, but I'm not having that.
Don't you say that, Dave.
I'm not having that.
Gomez, you pointed out, has made quite a few mistakes of late, but Mark Lawrenson did, in fairness to him, concede that, but he said long term, this 20-year-old kid.
Yeah, last fortnight he's been poor, and yeah, a couple of his major strengths, positioning and awareness that Keith listed there, have been absent. But yeah, as the future, and there's a lot of people that really want him kept centrally and not in the fullback position, where they've got a little bit of depth, particularly with Trent Alexander-Arnold making so much progress.
So tomorrow morning, 7:45 a.m. OTB AM, Owen Chair will be joined by Miguel Delaney talking about tonight's match and the week's football generally. Anthony Moyles will be in studio to preview the 2018 GAA season. It's here. Offtheball.com, Facebook, Periscope. And then tomorrow night, in a novel twist, we have full live match commentary of West Ham Spurs. The crappy quiz runner-up, Nathan Murphy, will be alongside Kenny
Cunningham.
His
new moniker.
Yeah. Kenny Cunningham and Nathan will be at the London Stadium. So that will be good. West Ham against Spurs, live football on a Thursday night. So that'll be on from 7. And then, you're not on any games this weekend?
Not for my radio employers, no.
Oh, where are you?
I'm on FA Cup duty on Friday night.
For who?
Air.
Oh, very good.
Yes. Pals of ours.
Merseyside Derby.
Yes, I think. There are two games. United are playing Friday night as well. Suffice to say, you've just told the world that I haven't started my prep for that game.
No kidding. Bloody hell. Glad you're relaxed in your job. Okay. So that's pretty much us done for this evening. Tom Dunn is on the way. A reminder, by the way, on the on Sunday's radio show, because there's no Premier League, obviously, we have a busy 5-hour show. We will be starting with a review of the Sunday papers. We'll have Paul Kimmage and Padraig Harrington reviewing the Sunday papers.
That's unmissable.
Come on. Like, come on.
That is unmissable radio.
So, who knows how long we'll be on the air for. The rule will be, because we're in no rush with live football afterwards, to when they're both done, we're done.
So they still be going at 4:30.
There's a chance. There's a chance Harrington will have lots to say. So I'm interested, because I know he has a resolute, diehard rule that he doesn't listen to a word said about him. But I think he's quite into sports media and follows sports media, so interested to know what paper he likes to read of a Sunday. So that'd be good. We're done. Tom Dunn is on the way. Dave, thanks for coming in this evening.
Thank you.
Much appreciated. And we'll talk to you tomorrow.
Off the Ball on News Talk 106 to 108.
And we shall wonder if one day our game is played on the other planets. We will have interplanetary competition.
Your job now is to stand by our new manager.
I always said if I was Aladicio, they'd probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
If my granny had bought, you'd be the granddad.
Big Sam Aladicio, that's right.